Acts 13, and we read from the 13th verse. Acts 13, verse 13. Now when Paul and his company loosed from Paphos, they came to Perga in Pamphylia, and John, departing from them, returned to Jerusalem. And when they departed from Perga, they came to Antioch in Pisidia, and went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and sat down. And after the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent unto them, saying, Ye men and brethren, if ye have any word of exhortation for the people, say on. Then Paul stood up, and beckoning with his hand, said, Men of Israel, and ye that fear God, give audience. The God of this people of Israel chose our fathers, and exalted the people when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt, and with an high arm brought he them out of it. And so on. Now in these verses we follow Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey. Remember last time John Mark deserted them at Perga. Verse 13 we read that when they came to Perga in Pamphylia, John, departing from them, returned to Jerusalem. Now this must have been quite a blow. After all, here are three men and one deserts, and so a third of their party is lost. And John was a necessary and a valuable helper. They wouldn't have taken him along with them if he were not. Back in verse 5 of this chapter, we read that they had to their minister. He ministered to Paul and Barnabas. He was a great help to them and would have been a great help further on the journey. And so it was a loss, and it must have been an undermining thing. It must have been a blow to their morale, if you like, to have lost such a good man. And yet we find that it doesn't make any difference, because the next verse tells us, verse 14, but when they departed from Perga, they came to Antioch and Pisidia, and so on. You see, at the end of the day, if you believe that God has called you to be somewhere and to do his work in that place, then human factors are not going to change that. The loss of John Mark does not mean to say that Paul and Barnabas have to abandon their missionary journey. It's a loss, and it is true. But the Lord is still there, and they have their call, and they have their sufficiency from above. And so they press on. It reminds me of what Paul was to prove later on in his life in 2 Timothy chapter 4, where we read these poignant words, and yet there his faith triumphed as well. 2 Timothy 4 verse 16, he appears before the emperor on trial for his life. It ends in him being condemned to death and eventually being executed. But this is what Paul says, 2 Timothy 4:16. At my first answer, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. I pray God that it may not be laid to their charge, notwithstanding the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, that by me the preaching might be fully known, and so on. You see, if people desert you, if people no longer stand with you, the Lord will stand with you, and he will be there still, And ultimately that's all that matters. And the loss of people means that we prove the Lord all the more. And that at the end of the day is the test of true godliness, isn't it? Where are we really putting our trust? Who are we really leaning on? People or the Lord? When people go, the Lord is still there. And now they can press on because God will not fail them. Now Luke tells us the route that Paul and Barnabas took. Just in a few words, they departed from Perga and they came to Antioch in Pisidia. Now, those few words cannot possibly convey what that journey would have meant for these two men. It was a journey of 100 miles from Perga, more or less on the coast of what is now Turkey. They press north and they have got to cross the Taurus mountain range, and it's a very dangerous pass where they have gone through. Dangerous because of the terrain, the highest peaks of 12,000 feet. Dangerous because of the climate, you could get malaria there easily. And dangerous because the place was infested with robbers. And here are Paul and Barnabas, all on their own, humanly speaking, making their way through this 100-mile trip from Perga inland, striking north to Antioch in Pisidia. It's believed that Paul's words in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 26, come from this time, some of them at any rate, where he recounts the things that he has endured for the gospel's sake. 2 Corinthians 11:26, he says, in journeyings often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, and so on. But they press on through, and eventually they reach this place, Antioch. Not the one in Syria, the church at Antioch, which sent them on the journey in the first place. This is another Antioch, same name, in a place, a region called Pisidia, in the area of Galatia. Now notice here, they stop, and on the Sabbath day, they go into the synagogue. Now this is interesting, and it was their practice, always, from now on. Because you see, in the synagogue, were Jews. And so strategically they start with people who have some biblical background, and they are able to preach. Paul does in verse 17, he's able to speak of the God of Israel who chose their fathers and so on, and he's able to recount Israel's history. People with some biblical understanding, knowledge and history, and he presents the gospel to them before going to the Gentiles outside. You find that eventually, as churches are planted, Jews comprise the congregation, Gentiles comprise the congregation, all united in Christ, but beginning with Jews in the synagogue. Interestingly, this is the only synagogue address of Paul that is preserved. In all the other places he visited, we read that he preached to them in the synagogue and so on, but this is the only one that is preserved here in Acts chapter 13. In chapter 17, you find the only address to the Gentiles that's preserved. His speech on Mars Hill, remember, to the Greeks there. So, these are specimens then of his preaching, and this one here is a specimen of his preaching to the Jews. But we'll stay here this evening in the synagogue at Antioch, and let's ask ourselves, what does this have to teach us? And two things. First of all, the people. Now, notice the details here. The two men go into the synagogue on the Sabbath. It was a practice in those synagogue services that if one of the rulers of the synagogue happened to see someone who looked like a visiting rabbi or some other competent Jew, that he would ask the man to speak to the assembly. Now you can imagine, can't you, Paul and Barnabas entering the synagogue. And especially Paul, he had all the look of what he was, didn't he? He would have looked the scholar, looked the Jewish teacher, looked the high-ranking man with his bearing and demeanor, and Barnabas too, to an extent. And so when the ruler said, verse 15, "Men and brethren, if ye have any word of exhortation for the people, say on." Paul stood up and, beckoning with his hand, began to speak. Paul finds that he has an excellent opportunity to present the gospel. But notice that it is a mixed company. Verse 16. He says, "Men of Israel, and ye that fear God, give audience." Now there are two groups of people here. The men of Israel would be the Jews born as Jews and steeped in their religion. But ye that fear God, who were these? Well, these would have been Gentiles, but Gentiles who were in attendance at the synagogue. They would have been people who had become weary of idolatry, weary of moral degeneracy. And they had become attracted to the Jewish religion, the concept of just one God, the morality, the high morality of the Jewish religion, the family values they exhibited. And they had been drawn to these things and had become interested in the Jewish faith. They had not been proselyted, they had not become converts to Judaism, they hadn't become circumcised, but they were attenders, listeners, learners, with perhaps a view to that eventually. But you see, instead of superstitiously worshipping many gods, worshipping idols and so on, they were those who feared God. They had some knowledge of the one true God and the religion of the Jews. And so both are in attendance, and Paul speaks to both. These God-fearers, as we may call them, are perhaps rather like the unconverted people who attend the church. That they're not the Lord's, but they are attending and they are under the word. Now, dear friends, what a happy event that the gospel comes into this situation through Paul. The Jews need it, of course, but these God-fearers, they need it. And you see, they haven't found what their hearts are longing for in Judaism. You wouldn't find it there, because Judaism by now is spiritually bankrupt. Their house has been left to them desolate. They've rejected the Messiah, and God has dealt with them, and they have lost everything. And the gospel comes in as the only thing that can satisfy the needs of men's hearts. And here now they're there, and the gospel is heard. It's rather like the Ethiopian man, isn't it, in Acts chapter 8. He was another God-fearer. Acts chapter 8 verse 27. Remember, he'd been up to Jerusalem to worship at the temple. But there was nothing for him there. In verse 28, he was returning. And sitting in his chariot, he was trying to make something of Isaiah the prophet. And Philip is sent to preach Christ to him. And here these God-fearers are in this synagogue at Antioch, and Paul is sent to them to preach Christ to them. Their time, their opportunity have come. You see, the Lord works like this. He creates a felt need in people. There was no attributing these God-fearers' condition to their own initiative. You remember Cornelius and how that he was one as well? Acts 10 verse 2. He was a Roman soldier, but he was a devout man, one that feared God with all his house, gave much alms to the people, and prayed to God always. He's fearing God, you see, like these God-fearers here. Where does that come from? Well, Romans 3 and verse 8 says, there is no fear of God before their eyes. And if anyone does fear God, then it is a given thing, isn't it? The Lord has begun a work. And sometimes it can be a long journey, can't it? You see, here are these God-fearers at Antioch. And maybe they've sat under Judaism for a longish time. And they haven't found the truth. They haven't found rest for their souls. Their need is not immediately met. Can be like that, can't it? Maybe for some of us in our conversion, it was almost like a pilgrimage, wasn't it? We were awakened to a sense of need, but it was all very vague. We maybe went to this church and didn't find it anything. Maybe we went to that church and we came away empty. Maybe tried that faith or the other cult, seeking. We were fearing God. We had reverence and respect. We longed for, we hardly knew what, but we knew we hadn't got it. And it seemed as if it was a long, long time. And the Lord sometimes deals with people like that, you see, because when they find all that their hearts need in Christ, they know that they found it. And they know there's no mistake in it. As the hymn puts it, O Christ, in thee my soul hath found, and found in thee alone, the peace, the joy I sought so long, the bliss till now unknown, now none but Christ can satisfy. Oh, what a blessed thing it is at our conversion, when after maybe many months or even a year or two, after all the weary searching, as we thought, the Lord had been dealing with us, and he brought us at last to his Son and joined us to Jesus Christ, and we entered into life and salvation, peace, meaning, purpose. And oh, how glorious it is. You see, what's happening here is this very thing. And Paul is brought, Barnabas is brought to the synagogue at Antioch for these God-fearers apart from anyone else, so that their weary search, their pilgrimage can be at an end. How shall they hear without a preacher? Well, Paul becomes their preacher, and he brings glad tidings of good things, and they hear. And you see, they are blessed. Look down at verse 42, when Paul finishes his sermon. Verse 42 of this same chapter. And when the Jews were gone out of the synagogue, the Gentiles besought that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. And the congregation was broken up and so on. And Paul and Barnabas spoke to them, persuading them to continue in the grace of God. It was these God-fearers particularly, along with a number of Jews, who were converted at this time. Dear friends, let's remember the God-fearers. We have some in our congregation, don't we? It's nothing new, you see, to find a mixed company in the assembly. True Christians, but those who are not Christians and yet are outwardly attached to the congregation and to the worship. And we are glad that they are here, aren't we? We are glad that they are under the word. but we must pray for them. The Lord will turn them from being merely God-fearers into those who know God personally and in a saving relationship with Jesus Christ. Men of Israel, and ye that fear God. Some of our God-fearing members of the congregation have been like that for many years, haven't they? Many years. And maybe the gospel message sounds to them so familiarly, like birds that make their nests in the bell tower, and the ring of the bell hardly is noticed by them anymore because they're so used to it. The joyful sound, so familiar, doesn't do anything for them. How we need to pray that the Lord will be gracious to them and awaken them. We can believe and hope that the very fact that they are in attendance with us is a token that the Lord means to do them good. So pray for them as we give thanks to God for them. Those who fear God, oh, may they come to know him through Jesus Christ. Well, that's the people on this occasion. Let's look secondly now at the place. Verse 14, Antioch in Pisidia. Now a look at a Bible map will show that this place, Antioch in Pisidia, is actually in the southern part of the Roman province called Galatia. So these converts at Antioch then, and the other cities, could be called Galatians. And who did Paul write to? Just a few years after this missionary journey, his epistle to the Galatians. And some of the very ones, the Jews and the God-fearers, converted on this occasion, would have been in the churches, Antioch and the other cities round about, and that they received Paul's circular letter to the Galatians. Now, dear friends, there's a rather sad sequel to this, as you know, because if you turn to the epistle to the Galatians, you'll see that for the Gentile section, those Gentiles who were converted, we find Galatians 1 verse 6. Paul writes rather urgently, doesn't he, in this letter. And he says, I marvel that ye are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel. And you know that another gospel, which is not another really, but is virtually another gospel, is this. That these Gentile converts had listened to Jewish false teachers, Christians, professing Christians, but false teachers who told them that in order to be a fully fledged Christian, you've got to be circumcised, like the Jews, and you've got to keep the festal days of the Jewish calendar, and you've got to take on board other elements of Jewishness. It's amazing, dear friends, isn't it? The very things that couldn't meet their need in the beginning, when they were just God-fearers, Jewishness. They have been called into the grace of Christ and found their all in him. And now they're tempted to turn aside to those things, those weak and beggarly elements that didn't satisfy them back then. Circumcision and the rest. Look what Paul says about it in chapter 5 of the Epistle to the Galatians. Galatians 5 and verse 2. He's quite clear on this, isn't he? Galatians 5 verse 2. Behold, I, Paul, say unto you, that if ye be circumcised, Christ shall profit you nothing. And that's a very solemn thing. Elsewhere in the epistle he speaks of being fallen from grace. If you turn aside to the legal and the letter of the Jewish religion, you can illustrate it like this, you see. Supposing you're up a very high tree, and of course you're standing on stout branches, but supposing one branch is sound, and one foot is on that, but the branch on the other side of the tree is rotten, and your other foot is on that. Now if you put your weight up, then what's going to happen is the rotten branch will give way and you'll fall. And you see, it's all right having the one sound branch, but if the other branch is rotten, then the sound branch will profit you nothing and you'll fall. It'll let you down. And you see, Christ plus circumcision means a sound and a rotten branch and you'll fall. You're not trusting wholly to the Saviour and to the all-sufficiency and finality of what Christ has done. And for Paul, therefore, it's another gospel. It's turning aside, falling from grace. Everything is in jeopardy. What a solemn thing. Here, these God-fearers who first were called into the grace of Christ at Antioch, and now they're turning away from the grace of Christ, being lured by that Jewishness which never could have done them any good. Reminds us, doesn't it, dear friends, that we may rejoice over new converts, but we should rejoice with trembling, because we never know into what new converts may stray in time to come, and how new converts need to be protected, covered by prayer, that God will keep them in the narrow way of truth and in the narrow way of righteousness. But you see, for the Apostle Paul, it was very sad, because if you turn to Galatians chapter 4, what it led to was this, that they turned against Paul. They changed towards him. Galatians 4 verse 11, he writes to them, look, this is only 2 or 3 years after a number of them at Antioch had been converted, and then elsewhere in Galatia through his preaching. He writes to them, Galatians 4, or verse 10, look. Ye observe days and months and times and years. I am afraid of you, or for you, lest I have bestowed upon you labour in vain. Brethren, I beseech you, be as I am, for I am as ye are. Ye have not injured me at all. You know how through infirmity of the flesh I preached the gospel unto you at the first. And my temptation which was in my flesh ye despised not, nor rejected, but received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. Where is then the blessedness ye spake of? And so on. Verse 16, have I become your enemy because I tell you the truth? Sad, isn't it? You can imagine, can't you, at Antioch in the beginning, when Paul was their spiritual father and they were his spiritual children. Oh, how they loved him. How they loved Paul for being the bearer of the good news that had saved their souls. But look, where is then the blessedness you spake of? Am I become your enemy because I tell you the truth? If you look further into these verses, Galatians 4, you'll see something interesting. Notice he says, ye know how through infirmity of the flesh I preached the gospel unto you at the first. My temptation or trial in the flesh. Then he says, verse 15, if it had been possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and have given them to me at that time. Such was your love to me. It's believed that when he was at Antioch, he came preaching with a severe eye condition, inflammation of the eyes. Some believe that it may well have been his thorn in the flesh that he speaks about later on in the New Testament that was not taken from him. But whatever. Back then, you see, these Galatians loved him so much, if they could have, they'd have plucked out their own eyes and given them to the apostle. That's the extent of their devotion to their spiritual father. And you know, it is a very wonderful relationship. The relationship between someone who is instrumental in another's conversion and that spiritual child. One of the most precious aspects of being a pastor is that when you are used for the conversion of someone, you become someone very special in their lives, in a spiritual sense. And I know what I owe to those who helped me to the faith. And you know what you owe to those who helped you to the faith. And isn't it true that somehow that person or persons, there's no one that can take their place? That's special. They are special people. You don't make gods of them or inflate them or put them on a pedestal, but oh, you love them. You love them almost as much as your own flesh and blood, because you owe your souls to that person or to those people. And you would do anything for them, anything at all, such as your love for them, your gratitude toward them, wouldn't you? And it's a very wonderful thing. Paul can speak of my own son, Timothy. Timothy's love for the Apostle Paul. Same thing again, you see. And over again it happens. Wonderful. And all the Galatians would have done without their own eyes if they could have only transplanted their good eyes in the place of Paul's bad eyes, so that their dear apostle could have seen better. That's the extent of their love for Paul. What a wonderful thing. But dear friends, correspondingly, you see, how heartbreaking when you see it all go. How heartbreaking. And it goes, not because you change, not because the spiritual father changes. It goes when the convert changes. And I have seen it. I've had this. And it is a heartbreaking thing, it really is. And someone that would have given their own souls to you suddenly becomes almost your enemy. And the person at one time whom they would have been most delighted to have received a visit from, the pastor, becomes the last man they want to see. And there's not only a cooling off, but there's a turning against. And by the nature of the case, it's like that, you see. Such is the strength and ardour of gratitude and love in the first place. And now, conversely, the strength of, well, enmity and avoidance on the other side. Because they've changed. It's a very sad thing. Very sad. Where is the blessedness which he spake of? There you record, plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. Am I become your enemy? Because I tell you the truth. But it didn't stop Paul, did it, doing all he could for these Galatians. Oh, look at verse 19. My little children, of whom I travail in birth again until Christ be formed in you. And oh, he writes this whole epistle. And sometimes it sounds severe, but it's only the severity of love and the yearning in his soul for their recovery and for their restoration. Other times he pours his heart out in the most tender fashion, seeking to bring these back to the faith of Christ. This is the epistle to the Galatians. But he lost a number of them, I think. And a number of them never were what they were before. Maybe some were recovered, but there were numbers here who were a great sadness and disappointment to the Apostle Paul. And you see already, in the course of this word tonight, two instances now where the Apostle Paul has known disappointment. John Mark gone? All these hopeful converts, or a number of these hopeful converts of Antioch and Galatia, a number of those gone as well. And what is it teaching us? And what about when we are disappointed in people? Christian friends gone. Those we looked up to let us down. Those we trusted and looked to fail us. Grieve our hearts. What's it all teaching us? John Mark, the Galatians, and so on. It's teaching us this, dear friends, that the Lord alone must be the basis of our trust and our comfort. Vain is the help of men. Trust not in man, neither in the Son of Man, in whom there is no help. Christians will let us down and will fail us. There'll be the John Marks, there'll be the Galatians who turn away and fail. Even the best and most encouraging of our friends in the Lord maybe will fail us and let us down. And by the time we get to heaven, by God's grace, we will have many a disappointment on the way. Mark my words, many a disappointment. And sometimes there will be people who will defect and fall and turn back, that will shake us rigid. Howl, fir tree, because the cedar hath fallen. But it's all to teach us not to put our trust in them, but in the Lord alone. The Times newspaper today. Roy Clements, Dr. Roy Clements, pastor of Eden Baptist Church, Cambridge. For 20 years, one of the premier Reformed Baptist churches in this country. And after 20 years in the pastorate, and 29 years married with 3 children, he's left his wife and has gone to live with another man. These are the days in which we are living, dear friends. And you see, at the end of the day, we do not put our trust in men, and shocked and dismayed though we are, even when there are things like this taking place, it's the Lord, isn't it, who must be our strength and our stay. And that's what all our disappointments are for, to draw us closer to Him. Psalm 61 and verse 2, when my heart is overwhelmed, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. He must be our refuge. You see, when such things as this happen, there are numbers of Christians who are so shaken. They don't go to church anymore. They fall away. They lose their faith. They're so shattered. And how is that? Likely because the basis of everything is wrong, the foundation is wrong. Don't put your trust in men. It must be the Lord, and the Lord alone, so that when the worst of things happen around us, God is our refuge and strength, and very present help in trouble, and He is our strength and stay. In my own home church at Ilfracombe, there was an extremely gifted youth leader who, under God's blessing, built up the young people's side of the work, as we say, to the point where there were 300 children in the Sunday school, where we could go away for a week's house party with 200 young people and helpers. each Easter, where there were conversions on a regular basis amongst young people and adults in the church, and to the point where people in the town of Ilfracombe, standing on the high street in ordinary conversation, would say, "What's going on at that church? What's going on at Brookdown? Don't go down there. If you do, you'll get converted." He left his wife and went off with a younger married woman. And suddenly, astonishingly, almost most of the young people suddenly fell away and are nowhere to this day. And it led eventually to the falling apart of the whole church. You see, you must be careful that you don't put your trust in them. However highly you may esteem them, however much you may depend upon them under God, at the end of the day it must be the Lord alone who is the one that you look to, trust in, lean on, and the one who is always the basis of your comfort. Paul found it when he lost John Mark, he lost a number of the Galatians, he lost Demas, didn't he? He'll lose many others, and will lose people as well. But he hath said, "I will never leave, nor forsake thee." So let us examine ourselves, dear friends, and let's make God our sure foundation, and his word that rock, the impregnable rock, and let's keep close to him. Let us now sing together.